The fourth and final reading is from 2 Chronicles, chapter 36, the Tanakh's last word. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of Jehovah by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and put it also in writing, saying, "Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath Jehovah, the God of heaven, given me, and he hath charged me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whosoever there is among you of all his people, Jehovah his God be with him, and let him go up."
And those are the last words in the Hebrew Scriptures, the Tanakh, Torah, Nevi'im, Ketubim. We're reading the Bible cover to cover, and we've just finished the Hebrew Scriptures. Christians call it the Old Testament, but we're reading it in the Hebrew Scriptures way, meaning that order, and it's a different order, and it ends with 2 Chronicles in that verse. Ezra and Nehemiah are about what happened after the exile and the coming back home to Judah and Jerusalem and rebuilding the temple. And then Daniel's also in there, and Daniel is probably the latest book. And it is rather apocalyptic about the vision of the future. The Bible is the search for home. It begins in the Garden of Eden, a perfect paradise, except that it's too small for the curiosity of Eve and Adam. No garden will contain the human spirit. It may be a home for animals and small children, but not for a particular species that has evolved moral agency. Not content to be placed in a garden while all is provided, the human sabotages its own home in its quest to push back boundaries, to question authority, to eat the forbidden fruit from the fig tree. Now, whether we think of this as something good or bad or something else tells us something about ourselves. Could we stay in a garden? How long before we too question the rules of the garden and push the limits? Once Eve and Adam have been cursed by the deity, expelled from the garden, and cherubim have been placed at the gates to guard it, humans toil, make love, give birth, and die east of Eden. The biblical story from Genesis to 2 Chronicles is the quest for home. The Tanakh ends with the invitation to go up. Go up to Jerusalem to the temple built by the Messiah, Cyrus, the Persian emperor. As Christianity took its turn, home moved away from Jerusalem, away from any point on earth, to a heavenly home, a new city. And John on the island of Patmos takes a good trip and has a vision from Revelation chapter 22. The angel showed me a river that was crystal clear and its waters gave life. The river came from the throne where God and the Lamb were seated. Then it flowed down the middle of the city's main street. On each side of the river are trees that grow a different kind of fruit each month of the year. The fruit gives life, and the leaves are used as medicine to heal the nations. God's curse will no longer be on the people of that city. He and the Lamb will be seated there on their thrones, and its people will worship God and will see him face to face. God's name will be written on the foreheads of the people. Never again will night appear, and no one who lives there will ever need a lamp or the sun. The Lord God will be their light, and they will rule forever. I'm sure you have wondered, as I have, what the difference might be between the Garden of Eden and this new city. Could we be happy and content there any more than Eve and Adam were content in the garden? Would we obey without question this time? Would we cease being human? The song Amazing Grace is an all-time number one hit on the Christian hit parade, and it contains this line: "When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun." I can't quite imagine that eternal sentence. Sure, vacation from toil, tears, and worry will be a nice break, but forever? It won't take 10,000 years before I'll be ready to check out. eat some forbidden fruit, add a little excitement to the situation. We have a desire for home. We long for home. We pine for home, search for home, try to make home. And then we're not satisfied with home. It still needs work, we think. Do we wish to get out of the city or the suburbs and imagine a retirement home, away from it all? Then, after a time, we realize we're too far away from it all, and solitude turns lonely. Of course, billions around the world have hardly a home at all. Fear and hunger besiege their home. What is home like in Gaza, for instance? And it is to those that the promise of the prophet Micah is taken to heart. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. But they shall all sit under their own vines and under their own fig trees, and no one shall make them afraid. Then, of course, there are the threats, real and imagined, to our peaceful home. The immigrant, the foreigner, the other. So we build walls to surround our peaceful home, to keep them out, keep us in. And yet the real threat to home is death. Home invites illusions of permanence. No home, no matter how secure, beautiful, inviting, can keep us safe from death. One would think that we would get that. So why do we spend so much time trying to make something perfect when we know we are but passing through? That's what we do. Like even Adam, we're not satisfied, even when permanence is not an illusion. So given that, how do we live? How do we live in our impermanent homes with 7 billion others? We cannot stop our own individual death, so it's up to each of us how we live with that existential reality. Find some kind of philosophy to deal with it. There are plenty from which to choose. But we ought to come up with some kind of shared philosophy of living together in this interim. Ezra and Nehemiah came up with a philosophy: build walls and be free of foreign influence. That's the go-to philosophy by leaders who capitalize on our existential fears. Protect yourself and wall yourself off from those who don't speak, think, act, or look like you. Wall them out and do not be influenced by them. They're out to get you and destroy you. How easy it is for our leaders to scare up an enemy and to mobilize against them. And when I say our leaders, I mean anyone's leaders at any time. It's the easiest and oldest trick in the book. Be afraid, build walls. This philosophy is spread like cancer in our own nation. In his latest book, theologian David Ray Griffin writes about the effects of 9/11. Justified by the events of September 11, 2001, the United States has engaged in the toppling of governments, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and now Syria, the shredding of the Constitution through the so-called Patriot Act, surveillance, and the metastasization of executive power. Other effects of 9/11 include obscene increases in military spending, murder by drone, preventive, preemptive strikes, and Islamophobia, to name a few. We are following the script of Ezra and Nehemiah. Be afraid, exclude foreigners, build walls. I don't know about you, but that's no home for me. Now, I harbor no illusions of building a perfect utopian home, but the neocon vision of home is death and destruction on a massive scale. Might there be another philosophy of home? Yes, there is. It's the philosophy of building bridges, not walls. Did you know that in the Beaverton School District, over 100 languages are spoken in the homes of our students? Did you know that in Beaverton, 1 out of 5 residents were born in a different country? Now, I'm not saying that Beaverton is a utopia and that we don't have challenges, but I am saying that we have an opportunity. In fact, we have a calling, a summons to be builders of bridges. Next Sunday, August 27th, Southminster will be hosting a Beloved Community Forum. These are monthly forums put together by the Interfaith Council of Greater Portland. And it would have been held at the Muslim Educational Trust, the MET, in Tigard. But a wedding and reception made that not workable this month, and so I was asked if Southminster could host. So I jumped at that, knowing this would be a great opportunity to continue our bridge-building work. This is information about this group. Starting with the premise that the opposite of fear is friendship, and the opposite of hate crime is building the beloved community, join a diverse cross-section of your neighbors on the fourth Sunday of each month to make new friends and deepen your community relationships. Each gathering will welcome a different community leader who will share their vision of what we are for here in Oregon and offer us a chance to discern and discuss what we are for as well. Refreshments will be provided. There you go, right there. Brought to you by the Beloved Community of Oregon. That's next Sunday, 5 o'clock, Southminster. You're welcome and encouraged to participate. I didn't have to do anything to make this happen. Building bridges is easy when the opportunity knocks on our door. This summer, we thanked a congregation, that is the Presbytery, thanked the congregation of St. Mark's Presbyterian Church for their long service. It came to a time when their journey had ended as a congregation, and a few friends from St. Mark's have been attending Southminster, and we're delighted to be able to make a church home for them. And one of the last acts of the session of St. Mark's was to entrust Southminster with $3,000 from its Abraham's Tent Fund. St. Mark's had held interfaith day camps for Jewish, Muslim, and Christian children and all of the neighborhood. And because they knew of Southminster's active work and interest in building bridges between faiths, they entrusted that money to us. So we now have an exciting opportunity to use that money to build interfaith bridges in our community. I'm hoping already your mind is spinning and working to think how Southminster might be able to use this important ministry that St. Mark's has begun. Building bridges is easy when opportunity knocks on the door. There's been much discussion in the news about the monuments to Confederate soldiers and generals. I think this is an opportunity. This is an opportunity to build some new monuments. Monuments to those whose history has been ignored and suppressed. Monuments of bridge builders and peacemakers. Monuments to people of color, the diversity of the rainbow, who have made life better and more whole for everyone. Monuments to people in Beaverton's own history who have built bridges and homes of peace. Building bridges is easy when the opportunity knocks on the door. The image on the bulletin cover, I see this image as an image of hope. On one side of the wall is destruction, and that destruction is the result of fear-mongering and wall-building that is all so common in our world. But then there's that crooked little ladder. Maybe it's a bridge to the other side of possibility, of opportunity, of courageous, heart-full and heart-filled bridge-building, a new beginning. Let's be for that.